Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, January 8th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. In his State of the State address, Idaho Governor Brad Little proposes $200 million for school facilities maintenance. He says he's against any proposals to fund private schools if it will drain money from public schools. That's as other Republicans in the legislature propose a tax credit for private school tuition. And body found near Newport, Washington, believed to be missing monk. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Idaho Governor Brad Little touted increases in education funding over the last 2 years during his State of the State address today at the state capitol in Boise, and he said he's focusing on the school facilities now. Governor Little proposed spending $200 million a year to fund school facilities maintenance next fiscal year and called for a 10-year commitment to spend $2 billion to repair and replace Idaho's public school building infrastructure, which is crumbling in many places.
Together, we've improved teacher take-home pay and boosted literacy. The improvements are making a difference, but we are far from meeting our obligation to maintain a general, uniform, and thorough system of public free common schools as required by the Idaho Constitution. One area in particular needs work, and that's school facilities. We've all seen the pictures and the videos of some Idaho schools that are neglected, crumbling, leaking, falling apart. In one school I visited, raw sewage is seeping into a space under the cafeteria. Folks, we can do better. The can we're kicking is getting heavier, and we're running out of road. Let's make this priority number one. My Idaho Works plan proposes the largest investment ever in school facility construction and our maintenance match, $2 billion. Not only will we make learning environments more productive for students, we'll get a twofer. This $2 billion investment in school facilities is $2 billion in long-term property tax relief.
Governor Little also used a video portion of his speech to tout his new Idaho Launch Program, which will award high school graduates up to $8,000 for college or job training for careers that are classified as in demand. As of January 1st, 54% of Idaho seniors had applied for the first year of Idaho Launch grants, and Governor Little is calling for another $75 million allocation for the program for the next fiscal year.
Before we get too far, I would like to congratulate the more than 12,500 students who applied for Launch. Lieutenant Governor Bedke and I traveled the state extensively over the past year to visit with many of these students. The interest in Launch far exceeded everyone's expectations, and we're excited for these young Idahoans. To keep that excitement going, every legislator is receiving an email right now with information on the students in their districts who applied for Launch. Looking ahead, go ahead. Looking ahead, we have a plan to keep Idaho strong. It's called Idaho Works. What we're doing is working, and the results speak for themselves. We must never get complacent. Idaho Works is about taking what we know has contributed to our state's tremendous success and not just prioritizing its continuation, but ramping up our efforts. We will work to raise the bar even higher because it's what our citizens expect, what they deserve from their elected leaders. But we must do so responsibly. We've all seen the trend. The economy is returning to normal. Idaho has seen revenue growth, but at pre-pandemic levels. That means we can't do it all. This session should be about priorities.
Idaho Launch passed in the House 36-34 last year, with the legislature's far-right contingent, along with some other conservatives, opposed. House Speaker Mike Moyle said last week the program is a government handout that could be a money pit. Moyle said government handouts generally don't work too well, and this is a big government handout. Earlier in his speech today, Governor Little genuflected to the far right on education issues, implying he thought the teaching of critical race theory is a bad thing.
On issues where it's important to take a stand, Idaho's led the charge. We're the first state to ban critical race theory in our schools. We're taking a stand that we should not divide our children. We introduced a new history curriculum for our Idaho schools, one that teaches students to appreciate and respect our country. We are a leader in education freedom. Idaho is a top 10 state for charter schools, and I'm bringing a bill this session to cut more red tape to support charter schools while providing taxpayers the transparency they deserve. To get more bang for our buck as the number one state for return on investment in education, we offer parents resources to support their children's education outside of the classroom. And Idaho came in first for the best new open enrollment law because we expanded opportunities for parents to choose the public school that is best for their child, regardless of their zip code. I will continue to support a fair, responsible, transparent, and accountable approach to expanding school choice in Idaho, one that doesn't draw resources away from our public schools. We also ban diversity statements in university hiring. Our academic freedom policies protect free speech on campus, while barring hateful, dangerous threats against the Jewish people. And we're pushing back on China. I banned TikTok and state government to protect our information from the Chinese government's sinister motives, and Idaho land cannot be sold to foreign governments that want to do us harm. We successfully ended an illegal encampment on public property right across the street from the People's House, a scene where drug use, sexual assault, violence, and destruction of property took place. We're showing left coast states how to stand up to activists who take advantage of the homeless and vulnerable. I was also the first state to sign a bill defending integrity in women's sports, and we will keep up the fight.
That last item was a reference to the law he signed to prevent trans women and girls from participating in college and K-12 level sports competitions, a bill sponsored by Republican Representative Barbara Ehart of Idaho Falls. Governor Little also said in his speech, Idaho should place limits on the Medicaid budget, but he said the state should increase reimbursement rates for direct care workers because of a shortage in the state. Governor Little also called for work requirements for those benefiting from Medicaid expansion, which 61% of voters approved in 2018. Governor Little wrapped up his speech today by saying, "This is not the time to change course."
There's no need to change course, but we must raise the bar and never rest on our laurels. History may not remember our names and faces, but we have an opportunity while we're here to create a lasting legacy of good government. I'd like to end by quoting one of my good friends and mentors. Perhaps not known for his patience, he recounted his first week as a legislator in this chamber, in which he reportedly stood and said, "Mr. Speaker, let's get this show on the road." That, of course, was Governor Phil Babb. We lost Phil last year. He was the epitome of a public service. His legacy is distinguished by his unrelenting human rights leadership, determined fiscal conservatism, and enduring love for Idaho. So let me close with an ode to Governor Babb and say emphatically, let's get this show on the road. Let's get to work for the people of Idaho. Let's focus on the big thing, and let's all aspire to leave a legacy like Governor Batt, a legacy that will outlive us all. God bless Idaho.
That was Idaho Governor Brad Little giving his State of the State speech today at the Capitol in Boise.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by Hungadunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Hungadunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram. KRFP programming is also sponsored by
Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as Euros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh. Located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
Oregon ranks in the top five in a new report measuring how states spend on transportation. With the passage of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and Inflation Reduction Act, John Bailey with the Natural Resources Defense Council says transportation funds roughly doubled. His organization has evaluated how states are using that money and ranks Oregon fourth in the report. He says while the federal government writes the check, states have a lot of flexibility in how they can spend the money.
Congress has said to states, you can go be innovative and be creative about how you use this. You do not have to use this only for road construction. And so Oregon uses a relatively high percentage of that money to support fixing bridges, funding transit, and safer walking and biking.
Bailey says Oregon also passed clean car and truck rules. The NRDC used 22 metrics for the analysis, including measures for states planning for climate and equity concerns. Transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the country. Bailey says transportation policy is critical for rural areas, too.
Transit plays a very important role in getting people to work and getting people to school. I think there's a stereotype that that's strictly an urban thing, but that's really not the case. Rural transit plays an integral role in the transportation system in states all across the country.
Bailey notes that the transportation funding will be renewed in 2026, but likely not at the current levels.
So this is a unique time period to take advantage of it. It probably won't happen again for another generation.
California, Massachusetts, and Vermont are the only states to rank higher than Oregon for doing the most to improve equity and climate outcomes with the federal dollars. Washington State rounded out the top five, and Idaho was among the lowest ranked states at 44th. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Supervisor Cheryl Probert has named Buddy Carroll as District Ranger for the Palouse Ranger District. Carroll is a silviculturalist who has worked for 30 years in natural resource management for federal, state, and private entities. Carroll was also a member of the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest's Forest Plan Revision Team during the last 4 years. Supervisor Cheryl Probert released a statement last week saying Carroll, quote, will help lead us into a future of managing our national forests for resilience in the face of insects and disease, wildfire, and changing climate. A body found in a pond near Newport, Washington, late last week has clothing consistent with that of 64-year-old Saravasti Abbey Buddhist monk Geshe Tenzin Chodrak, who went missing in November. Chodrak, whose birth name is Dadul Namgyal, went for a walk on the Saravasti Monastery's 300-acre property in Ponderay County and disappeared. The Ponderay County Sheriff's Department issued a news release Thursday saying they responded to a report of a body floating in a pond near the abbey. Chodrak joined the Buddhist monastery early last year and was the first male resident teacher there. The U.S. Supreme Court Friday reversed a lower court decision and allowed Idaho's anti-abortion law that critics say will cause the death of pregnant women to go into effect while the court hears the case. The justices said they will hear oral arguments in the case in April. The Biden administration's Justice Department sued Idaho in 2022, saying the trigger law, which makes it a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison for anyone to assist in an abortion in order to prevent harm to the health of the mother, violates the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. U.S. District Judge B. Lynn Windmill put the law on hold in August 2022. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act requires emergency room doctors to stabilize patients in facilities that receive federal funds and requires health care providers to provide abortion care in emergency rooms if needed to treat an emergency medical condition. That's according to the Justice Department lawsuit. The Idaho law only allows such emergency treatment if the life of the pregnant woman is at risk, and maternal medicine practitioners have been leaving the state because of the ethical and legal implications of making such a determination. The federal law requires doctors to perform abortions in cases of severe bleeding, preeclampsia, and certain pregnancy-related infections, according to the Justice Department lawsuit. In a separate case from Texas before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel, all appointed by Republican presidents, decided to allow a similar law from Texas to go into effect. The decision on January 2nd before the appeals court in New Orleans was made by two judges who are Trump appointees and another who is a George W. Bush appointee. That decision upheld a ruling by U.S. District Judge James Wesley Hendricks, who Trump appointed to the bench. Hendricks wrote, "The Biden administration was placing the health of the pregnant person over that of a fetus." President Joe Biden issued a statement Friday night which said his administration, quote, "will continue to defend a woman's ability to access emergency care under federal law." The Associated Press reports the Biden administration's Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar wrote in a filing to the Supreme Court in the Idaho case, "For certain medical emergencies, abortion care is the necessary stabilizing treatment." Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador wrote in a brief to the High Court that the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act says nothing about abortion. After U.S. District Judge B. Lynn Windmill in Boise issued his ruling stopping enforcement of the Idaho law, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ordered the law to be fully enforced. All three of those judges were Trump appointees. However, an en banc panel consisting of many more Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges reversed that decision late last year and had set oral arguments for late this month. Labrador appealed to the Supreme Court, which has three Trump-nominated justices who were vetted before nomination to make sure they would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. The U.S. Supreme Court has now taken the decision out of the hands of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The case from Idaho will be the second major abortion case that the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to decide since their June 2022 decision overturning Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court will also hear a case this spring challenging the Food and Drug Administration rules for obtaining mifepristone, which is one of the two medications used for medically induced abortions. There's another case regarding the same Idaho abortion law before the courts. Four women and several physicians have sued in state court seeking clarification of the circumstances emergency medical workers can legally provide an abortion under Idaho's trigger law. In November, a federal judge temporarily blocked a separate Idaho law, the so-called abortion trafficking law. That 2023 law would prevent minors from getting abortions in a state where it is legal if they don't have their parents' permission. A court is expected to determine whether that law is constitutional. You're tuned in to KRFP Moscow. This is the KRFP Evening Report. A second district court judge, John Judge, in Moscow, accepted a plea deal Friday and sentenced the man who shot at least 80 rounds at occupied homes in Moscow September 5th to 10 years probation, along with an 8-year prison sentence, 2 years fixed, that he won't have to serve if he completes probation. In a plea bargain, Thomas Adams pled guilty to felony unlawful discharge of a firearm at a dwelling house. Police reports said they found bullet holes in three buildings after Adams used high-powered weapons to shoot from his balcony on Almond Street in the early morning hours. During a standoff, police closed a large portion of downtown Moscow to vehicular traffic until they took Adams into custody after 8 a.m., and the Moscow School District canceled classes at West Park Elementary School for the day because of the ongoing SWAT team situation. The plea bargain requires Adams to be under the jurisdiction of the Veterans Treatment Court in Lewiston and that he stay in the Nez Perce County Jail until they can find a sober living situation for him in the area. Sierra Valentine disagrees with the plea bargain that could leave Adams out of prison and in the community. Valentine was in court Friday and gave an emotional victim statement saying she had been dealing with Adams' creepy behavior in the neighborhood for months and said Adams shot at her specifically as she was walking her dog at about 2 a.m. By the time the shooting ended, there were 27 bullet holes in Valentine's home and karaoke shed, and a bullet had also damaged the power line to her home.
A day after the shooting, I stood where I almost died, not quite to the other side of the road, in front of the red building across from my home that I had owned for the last 14 years. I turned around, raised my eyes to see if I could even see his porch. I had a fleeting and foolish hope that maybe he hadn't tried to murder me. But I saw his porch, the porch that haunts me to this day. Finding out that Thomas Adams had indeed attempted to murder me with a silencer was such foreign in concept to my brain. So, whatever. Hearing through the grapevine how much ammunition and how many guns he had collected and stashed in his apartment, accompanied by the fact that he had clearly targeted me, made me feel sick. Someone literally wanted to see me dead and tried his best to make it happen.
That was Jackson Street resident Sierra Valentine giving her victim statement in district court in Moscow Friday. Valentine and court records stated a few hours before the shooting, police escorted Thomas Adams away from Sierra Valentine's property on Jackson Street and back to his apartment on South Almond Street, where they observed three assault rifles on his living room floor. Police at the time noted Adams appeared delusional. When Judge John Judge asked prosecuting attorney Jessica Urig why police did not want to charge Adams with attempted murder, Urig replied police did not have probable cause that Adams was shooting at Valentine in the dark.
Ms. Valentine is, you know, in her victim statement, describes that she may have been a target, okay, from some of the shooting that easily could have killed her. So she's suggesting this was attempted murder. So can you give me
Ms. Valentine has spoken with police, and they've made those investigations. Based on all of their investigation, they didn't feel they had probable cause to file charges for attempted murder.
Okay. Because, what, his mental health, or?
No, Your Honor. They didn't feel that she was specifically targeted.
Okay.
In nighttime, in the dark.
Okay. So it was more of a random shooting, is what that's what they determined?
Yes. And that is why we charged for striking just occupied buildings. There wasn't really a...
And that's what law enforcement had determined?
Yes.
Was there any discussion about why they didn't take the guns when they realized that he was not thinking clearly?
I believe there was an internal process that audited that, and that was left to MPD, but it was an administrative process, yes.
Okay. Just an aside, it seems to me if anybody's incredibly intoxicated and in a psychosis state and there's a whole bunch of guns sitting around, that it would make some sense to take those away. It just seems so obvious. So that was a big mistake.
For his part, Thomas Adams told the court he wasn't in his right mind at the time of the shooting, and he was hearing voices and saw faces. He said he wanted to tell Ms. Valentine, "I'm sorry," and he said he wished it had never happened.
I just want to say how thankful that I am that I didn't hurt anybody.
I wasn't in my right mind, and I just went. I heard voices. I saw pictures of men in my face. I could see them. I could hear them. And even though they weren't there, the psychologist at the treatment center said that's 100% accurate. You can read them. You can see them. And that's the crazy part about the brain, is that left untreated, which I was, often turns out like this with lesser impacts. But I just wanted Miss Valentine to know that I'm certainly sorry. I could have hurt her, and I wish I had never had that happen.
Why'd you have so many guns?
I've competed for the last 25 years once I got out of the Navy for time, points, everything.
Well, did you realize as your mental health was getting more serious that maybe you shouldn't have them?
Honestly, I didn't, sir.
And apparently you were suffering from some addiction issues?
Yes, sir.
Was that alcohol or some other things?
It was Xanax.
Oh, okay. So tell me what you learned at your inpatient treatment.
Triggers and how to stop them before they happen. The biggest thing is not to keep it going, but to stop it and reshuffle it.
And what were your triggers?
I'm sorry?
What were your triggers?
I have more than I thought I would. Everything from music on the radio to television. I get that fluttery anxiety feeling.
Have you been suffering from this mental health issues for a long time?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you're a trained nurse?
I am, sir.
Did you ever seek help for this?
I saw a psychiatrist and a sociologist in Idaho Falls before I moved here in January.
Okay, and did they diagnose you?
Yes, sir.
They gave you medication?
Yes, sir.
And that didn't help?
It could have been helpful more. It could have been more.
Did you stop taking your medication?
I was trying to do the right thing and quit drinking and quit using the benzodiazepines at once. And I did it cold turkey, which is the way not to do it. It threw me into a pseudo coma.
And you're saying this is what happened that night?
It is, sir.
Okay, and then there was a lot of alcohol that was added into that?
Once I figured I was going into the DTs, I tried to drink myself out of it. And I drank about half a bottle, sir.
Judge John Judge said it was difficult to decide between prison and probation in this case because sometimes people get out of prison without any treatment and there is recidivism. And he feels mental health treatment can reduce the risk to society.
We are actually driven by the law, and with regard to sentencing, we do have a statute that tells us to sort of follow with certain factors in 1925-21. And I kind of touched on this earlier because the primary consideration of the protection of society. And that is right at the heart of kind of figuring out what is the best thing to do in this case for Mr. Adams. Are we going to protect society by just separating him from society, by putting him in prison for a long period of time? I can't remember the maximum penalty of this charge. It was 10 years? It is 10 years, isn't it, Ms. Urig? I think that's the maximum.
Yes, I believe it is.
So with regard to protecting society, we've learned after, you know, I don't know how many years, a lot of years, that when we separate somebody from society and we put them in prison, well, it costs a lot of money, for one thing. But they get out of prison without any treatment, and they recidivize, okay? They commit, that means they commit new crimes. But if we can, okay, address the underlying problem that caused the crime, then maybe things are safer in the community. And it's a tough call, really, to make that happen.
That was District Judge John Judge speaking at the sentencing of Thomas Adams Friday. Judge said probation officers will need to monitor Adams very closely, along with the 8-year sentence with 2 years fixed that he won't have to serve if he succeeds at probation. Judge sentenced Adams to the maximum allowed 10 years probation and granted a 10-year protection order during which he is to have no contact with Valentine. Judge also said probation officers will have the power to require Adams not to associate with anyone that they don't approve of. He will lose his Fourth Amendment rights. He will not be allowed to own a firearm for the rest of his life, cannot possess alcohol or controlled substances, cannot go into bars or liquor stores, and will be subject to random and frequent drug testing. He also said officials can order discretionary jail time at any point during the probation. And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, the National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory, which will remain in effect until 10 a.m. tomorrow. Snow expected, total snow accumulation 2 to 6 inches, locally higher amounts possible from the Idaho Palouse north to north of Coeur d'Alene, winds gusting up to 50 miles per hour tomorrow morning. Plan on slick road conditions. The hazardous conditions will impact travel tonight into tomorrow. Strong winds could cause localized damage to trees and power lines. Localized higher snow amounts are possible where snow is slow to transition into rain Tuesday. Winds will increase Tuesday after most of the snow has fallen. Gusts up to 45 miles per hour possible by Tuesday afternoon. Slow down and use caution while traveling. There also is a wind advisory in effect starting at 4 a.m. tomorrow until 4 a.m. Wednesday for the Washington-Idaho Palouse, the Lewiston area, Lewis and Southern Nez Perce counties, Coeur d'Alene and Spokane areas, Moses Lake area, and the Upper Columbia Basin. Southwest winds 25 to 35 miles an hour with gusts 45 to 55 miles per hour expected. Gusty winds will blow around unsecured objects. Travel will become difficult for high-profile vehicles. Tree limbs could be blown down and isolated power outages may result. Winds this strong can make driving difficult, especially for high-profile vehicles. Use extra caution. The forecast for the Moscow Pullman area is calling for 100% chance of precipitation tonight. Snow before midnight, then rain, temperature rising to 35 by 3 a.m. 1 to 3 inches of new snow overnight. Tomorrow, 60% chance of precipitation, rain and snow. Mostly cloudy, temperature falling to 32 by 5 p.m. Windy, west winds 30 to 35 miles per hour with gusts up to 50 miles per hour. New snow accumulation less than half an inch. Tuesday night, 60% chance of precipitation, rain and snow likely becoming all snow after 7 p.m. Mostly cloudy, low 25, very windy, southwest winds 30 to 35, decreasing to 20 to 25 after midnight. Winds could gust up to 55 miles per hour. New snow accumulation less than half an inch possible. On Wednesday, 70% chance of precipitation, snow likely before 10 a.m., then rain and snow likely, mostly cloudy, high 32. South winds 15, gusts up to 20. New snow accumulation 1 to 2 inches possible on Wednesday. 80% chance of snow Wednesday night, low 25, 1 to 3 inches possible. 100% chance of snow Thursday. Patchy blowing snow in the afternoon, high 31 and windy. New snow accumulation 2 to 4 inches possible Thursday. Currently 30 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP. Be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. You can also go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. And you can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. And once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Also on the website, you can stream KRFP and listen to archived editions of the KRFP Evening Report and any show broadcast on KRFP in the last 2 weeks. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. Flashpoints is up next. Music begins with Zach Dunoir on the air, 7:30 till 9 o'clock. And then Chia Pets on to play music for you, 9 to 11. At 11 o'clock, syndicated world music with the Motherland Influence till 1 a.m. Stay tuned for more.